You're listening to a selection of stories from this week's Morning Ireland.
Thousands of undocumented migrants living illegally in the United States were this weekend braced for nationwide raids by the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Service that President Trump promised would lead to a wave of deportations. In the event, the operation in nine major US cities targeting around 2,000 illegals seems to have been on a far smaller scale than promised, at least for now. In a moment, we'll be hearing from a Limerick-born immigration lawyer based in the US. But first, the case of one Irishman already in detention and facing deportation, details of which emerged at the weekend. Keith Byrne from Fermoy in Cork has lived in the US for the last 12 years, is married to a US citizen with whom he has two children. He was arrested last Wednesday and is currently in detention in Philadelphia. We can talk now to Keith's sister, Melinda Byrne, who joins us on the line. A very good morning to you, Melinda Byrne, and thank you indeed for talking to us and welcome to the programme.
Hello, good morning, and thanks for having me.
Can I ask you just first of all to remind us, if you will, of the circumstances of Keith's arrest and detention? He was on his way to work last week, is that right?
He was on Wednesday morning, and could I just clarify before we begin that Keith was actually a documented individual in the US, and until now he has been legal, operating a business. You know, he had a tax identification number, social security number. So to be included under the illegal immigrant status is incorrect, so to speak. You know.
He was dealing and had dealings with US immigration agencies in an attempt to regularise his situation, to legalise his situation.
Well, it was, as I said, he was legal, but he didn't have citizenship, and that is the issue.
He was on their radar, though, as it were. They knew about him. He wasn't in hiding.
He wasn't in hiding. What had happened was that he had initially gone to America as a holiday, and actually the week that he was due to return home, because he had overstayed his visa, he met with Karen. He decided to stay. And in order to make a life, he went in 2010 under the visa waiver program. He paid a waiver because obviously he had originally overstayed the visa and made an application for citizenship back in 2010 with his wife. You know.
So had he any forewarning that he might be facing what he's now facing, which was his detention and potentially his deportation?
No. There was no, it was a shock for the family because they have been making applications and subsequent appeals, and they were in the middle of another appeal when I suppose he was easy picking due to the fact that, you know, he came forward to ICE initially with all his information. You know, they knew where he lived. He'd bought a house they had bought a house recently. And, you know, he was living like any other individual, best that he could.
So I presume he has lawyers working on this, if he's been involved in this process. Melinda, what are they saying now about what might happen?
The lawyers, he actually had began with Joe Hohenstein back in 2010 with his application. And the problem now is in the deportation process, or even under a visa waiver program, you also waive your right, as far as I'm aware, under the U.S. law, the U.S. immigration law, to a right to a hearing in front of a judge. So potentially, it's difficult to carry out a legal challenge because of the visa waiver removal program. It doesn't permit challenges except in extreme cases. And I think with Keith's situation, I'm sure we can agree that this is an extreme case. You know.
Right. And what you've been speaking to him, I think, is that right? He is able to make calls from the correction facility, it's described as, that he's been held in?
It is, but it's actually a jail. He's in a cell, you know. So that's difficult for the family, as it is difficult for Keith. You know, he went to ICE. You know, he did everything by the book. He paid a fine and he has suffered as a result of a mistake as a youth, you know.
And so when you've had an opportunity to speak to him, what has he said for you? How have you found him?
He has his moments, you know. I suppose he has a lot of guilt, you know, because of his family situation now. And I suppose he did go to America for, you know, initially it was, you know, to get away from everything, and he was traveling and, you know, make a new life, I suppose, and see the world, you know.
And now he's facing...
Karen, and his world is turned upside down, and now it's turned the other direction, and facing a return to Ireland, which he doesn't want. I suppose his life is in America. His stepson and two children are in America. And, you know, what I would say is, in a way, the U.S. government have facilitated the eventuality here. You know, he has remained legal in the U.S. Mm. He had a life. He had work permits. He had driving license. He had social security number. And he lived as a
But ultimately,
a legal,
it seems
documented individual, you know.
Ultimately, it seems he doesn't have that right to say, and he didn't have that final legal block in place, as it were. And deportation seems to be what he's facing in the immediate future. Yeah.
Because unfortunately, yes, he's caught up with the current administrations and the clampdown.
All right, Melinda, look, there we leave it. Thank you very much for talking to us. That was Melinda Byrne, sister of Keith Byrne, Limerick-born immigration lawyer James O'Malley, who's based now in New York. He told me the situation faced by illegal immigrants like Keith Byrne can be particularly difficult to resolve.
Well, there are a few reasons, Brian, why this could happen to any person, actually, who's going through the visa system internally within the US. I guess the initial thing to say is that, and this affects many, many Irish people who come into the US, who come on visitor visas. It's called ESTA, E-S-T-A. It's an acronym for the visa-less system that the US has in place for tourists from many countries, Ireland included. Now, ESTA is terrific because it allows a person get on a flight with a round-trip ticket for no more than 90 days, and fly into the US and be a tourist and see the Statue of Liberty and the Grand Canyon and all that stuff, and then go back home. It makes the requirement of going to the American embassy and getting a visa unnecessary. So in the small print on ESTA, when somebody registers electronically for the ESTA system to use it, they're effectively promising, one, that they will return within 90 days, they will depart the US within 90 days maximum. There will be a tourist. There will not be a person who will seek employment or become employed in that 90-day period. And most of all, most significantly of all, they are promising that they, if they overstay the ESTA, the 90-day period, they waive any right to challenge the U.S. within the U.S. legal system a charge of deportation. Now, overstaying the ESTA automatically renders a person deportable. So that's a very significant set of contingencies that I just went through there.
So the large number then of Irish illegals and undocumented, many of them would be in this situation. They would have entered under this visitor visa. And as a result of that, their legal situation is, on the one hand, fairly clear-cut, but obviously very precarious in the context of this clampdown.
Yeah, absolutely correct. The bottom line, as they say, is if a person overstays the ESTA, they are in danger of being immediately deported and deportable. The term of art that the system uses here is expedited removal. And a person who uses ESTA agrees to that. They waive any right to mounting a defense to deportability. Now, it doesn't happen everybody. There are other contingencies that kick into place when someone is going through the green card system based, we'll say, on a relationship to a U.S. citizen. One of those is if the person has any other deportable offenses. Mm-hmm. For example, if somebody was convicted of a crime or something shows up. Now, the U.S. green card system is quite harsh, and it doesn't a lot of the time distinguish between petty crimes, serious crimes, and in-between crimes.
James, I imagine you're dealing with very many clients who are in these kind of situations, and they'll obviously be very anxious now as a result of these recent developments, these sweeps by the immigration agency. What advice are you able to give to you?
Absolutely correct.
What advice are you able to give to your clients?
Well, one is know your rights or know the limit of your rights within the system if your person entered an ESTA, and then know as best you can what you can do and what you cannot do in relation to a legal challenge to a charge of deportation. There are challenges that are successful, and there are waivers of deportation. And it's very technical. It's a bit of a minefield, to say the least.
What do people do if some of these agents turn up on their doorstep, knocking on the door?
Well, that's a terrifying situation. Again, they usually have to have some motivation to go to a person. The person must be somewhere in the system. They don't just turn up on day 91 of somebody having entered on ESTA and try to enforce a deportation order. There's usually some other motivation. Somebody has applied for a status, again, based on some perceived eligibility to adjust their status within the US, and perhaps have failed in that application. Then it all comes to light. Oh, by the way, you came on ESTA, you overstayed the 90 days, and now you're asking to change your status, but it's not working out for one reason or another. Therefore, we know where you are, and we know who you are, and we know that you are immediately deportable under this expedited removal of the ESTA guarantees.
Just finally, James, this operation hasn't been perhaps on the scale that might have been expected or even promised by President Trump. But would you expect it to continue now? Have the rules really changed fundamentally for those who are legally in the United States?
Yes, Brian. Firstly, it hasn't played out on the scale that we were expecting and told to expect initially some weeks ago, and then it was put off until supposedly today, this Sunday. It's a Sunday night here now, or early Monday morning, but we haven't heard anything in anything ultra dramatic on that scale. However, that's not to mean that it might not kick in tomorrow or Tuesday or any time. It seems that the administration is quite hell-bent on making a statement on this issue. I think the statements by the Trump administration and by Trump himself have been a bit cavalier and a bit unrealistic, to say the least, that millions will be deported. Well, that's just not going to happen for obvious reasons.
Lawyer James O'Malley speaking to us from New York earlier.
Lisa Smith, the Irish woman who travelled to Islamic State-controlled territory and is now being detained in a Syrian camp, has said she doesn't think she'll be coming back to Ireland. In an interview with journalist Norma Costello for RTE News, Lisa Smith also rejected the suggestion that she travelled there to fight alongside ISIS. Our reporter Connor Hunt is here with more. Connor, let's start at the beginning. Who is Lisa Smith?
She's 37 years old, Rachel, originally from Dundalk in County Louth, a former member of the Defence Forces. She converted to Islam in her 20s, and around 3 years ago, she left Ireland and headed to Islamic State-controlled territory in Syria. She married, she had a daughter who is now age 2. Her husband was killed. Now, as we know, Islamic State have been defeated in the area, and Lisa Smith is currently being detained in a camp in the north of the country, but she wants to return to Ireland. Obviously, this raises some serious security issues, and the question too as to what exactly was she doing over there. Now, journalist Norma Costello travelled to Syria for RTE News and interviewed Lisa Smith, who told her she did not go to Syria to fight alongside the Islamic State.
Do you think the Irish government and the Irish people will believe that you didn't fight?
I don't know if they would believe it or not, but that's the truth. No, whether they believe it or not, that's up to them, you know. But I'm telling you for myself. I didn't fight.
People in Ireland think you're a monster.
Really? Why, what did I do? I just joined the Islamic State and now I've become a monster? How? There's many people, the British and the Irish fought for many, many, many years, you know? If someone from England moved to Ireland, then what would they say about them? You know? Or the opposite, you know? Or any country, you know what I mean? Like, how am I a monster? I came here to Islamic State and I didn't do anything.
Now, Rachel, Lisa Smith is also asked about her role in Syria and the specific suggestion that she trained young girls in how to handle weapons.
Lisa, there's two kids that we're actually going to see later today that you did train.
Please bring them here.
Those children are too afraid of you. They don't want to see you. But, I mean, let me just run this scenario by you.
Are you sure it's me? Because they don't know my name.
Absolutely, Cosmo.
How did they know me? What did they know me as by?
Let me just run the scenario by you, and then you can...
Okay.
So basically you were teaching along with the Tunisian teacher, and you were teaching children in weapons, and the Tunisian teacher was being quite aggressive with the children. And you complained and said that the Tunisian teacher was being too aggressive and that they should be softer with the kids. And your complaint, exactly like the scenario you just painted out, was trumped by the Tunisian, the administration of the school. It's exactly what you said, agreed with, and you were kicked out of the school and you lost your job.
This is completely new news to me. This is so not true.
Lisa Smith, Connor, she also rejects, despite her involvement with ISIS, she rejects suggestions that she was radicalised.
Yes, she says that as a Muslim woman, she wanted to live in a Muslim state and asks what's radical about that. But she does acknowledge the existence of videos which show the brutality of the Islamic State. She says she never witnessed that and says that's not real Islam. But she acknowledges too there are concerns from some about her return to Ireland.
No. But I'm not out to do anything, you know. I told you, I'm just a person who came to the Islamic State like any of these. Yeah, I do know there is other people here with really extreme and radical views, you know. And I don't even want to communicate with these people, you know. But I'm not like this. I just came here and now it didn't work out.
Connor, as you mentioned at the start, she was a member of the Defence Forces for quite some time.
Yes, she joined when she was 19. She served as a private and she also spent time in the Air Corps working on the government jet. And as we can hear now, she got up close to leaders.
I like Marty. He was very sound. You know, Mary McAleish, she was down to earth as well. Who else? Micheál Martin, I liked working with him as well. I liked flying around him. He was okay. There was a few that were nice.
Lisa Smith, Connor, what about her return? What's known about what's likely to happen?
Well, in the past, the Taoiseach has said that all Irish citizens are permitted to re-enter the state, but that a security assessment would have to be carried out in this case. The Gardaí and Defence Forces are carrying out their own inquiries. The Department of Foreign Affairs has said a request for consular assistance has been made and that officials are continuing to work on that. A spokesperson said the case is being taken very seriously. Options are being explored. Lisa Smith herself says she doesn't know if the government are delaying and says she doesn't know what's going on and whether she will return. But she says if she does, she's concerned that her daughter will be seen as the child of a terrorist.
This is what I'm worried about, though. You know, I do have my concerns like going back to Ireland because of this, you know. And that's why I say, like, if things like that happened, I believe that things do be forgotten about in time. You know, right now, yeah, everything's public, everything's crazy, everything is, like, up in the air, you know. Then things die down. Then something else will happen in the world or something happen in Ireland and that will become a big thing. And over time, people forget about things, you know. In a year or 2 years, people forget things, 3 years, 4 years. New generations come, new life comes, new things happen and people forget, you know.
And that was Lisa Smith speaking there to journalist Norma Costello. Our thanks also to our reporter Connor Hunt. There'll be further coverage of this interview throughout the day on RTE news programmes and online, and a full interview on primetime tonight at 25 to 10 on RTE One television.
The Minister for Justice says that a recent High Court decision that anyone applying to be an Irish citizen must have unbroken residence here for a year before they apply is being dealt with as an urgent priority by his department. On Wednesday, Mr. Justice Max Barrett ruled that the Minister's discretionary practice of allowing applicants up to 6 weeks out of the country for holidays or work was not permitted by law, and that the law requiring continuous residence meant not leaving the country even for a day. Charlie Flanagan said he knew the ruling had alarmed many interested parties and left many people in an unsettled state. Jim O'Callaghan is here. He's Fianna Fáil spokesperson on justice and equality. Thanks for coming in to us. What do you make of this ruling?
Well, it is a very consequential ruling and it's going to have a significant impact, I think, on people who have applied for certificates of naturalisation. I think the judge in the ruling recognised the consequences of what he was doing, but in fairness to him, the language in the legislation is very clear. It says that a person who wants a certificate of naturalisation must have had a period of 1 year's continuous residence in the state immediately before the date of the application. The judge concentrated on the word continuous. He said it was clear what it meant. It meant that it had to be unbroken, uninterrupted. And then if you were out of the country for a period of time, even for one day, well, then your residence wasn't continuous. So I think we need to draft amending legislation to change it, to ensure that people who are applying can deal with the ordinary vagaries of life. People have to go away for work sometimes, or they go away on the holidays. And I think the way the state has applied it is the correct way, and we just need to reflect that in new legislation.
We were speaking to Brian Killoran, the CEO of the Immigrant Council of Ireland, earlier, who said that there are potentially thousands of people who are either in the process of applying or, more to the point, are about to apply. Some of those include people who have been living on the island of Ireland for a very long time and who might want to regularise or change from being British citizens to being Irish citizens. Now, the judge in this decision on Wednesday said, to quote, that the decision might seem unfair, but he said the cure for any unfairness lies in the gift of the legislature. In other words, this won't come down to an appeal, but will come down to a change in the law in the Dáil, yes?
Well, I suppose the applicant in this case, Mr. Jones, who brought the case and who lost, he may want to appeal the case. So we don't know as of yet whether or not there will be an appeal. But if there isn't an appeal by him, and we won't find that out for, I think, another week or so, well, then in that instance, the minister will need to draft amending legislation and the Oireachtas will have to...
The minister can't appeal the decision, is that right?
Well, the minister won the case, so you don't really appeal a case that you win, you know, so it's highly unlikely that's going to happen. But the way to resolve it, like, I think when you look at the judgment, the judge is probably correct in his ruling, and I do think we need amending legislation. I think the minister should draft that amending legislation now. I also think it'll be necessary for him maybe to pause the consideration of the applications that are before him at present. Obviously, the whole purpose of a certificate of naturalisation is to ensure that people who have displayed a commitment to Ireland and who've lived here for a period of time are entitled to have that recognised through citizenship. And obviously, I don't think there's going to be huge prejudice if that isn't dealt with until mid-September.
Yes, because the usual process is that you need to be living here for 5 years within the last nine. But the issue in case here is that you need to be continuously resident for the 12 months prior to your application. The minister says that this needs to be dealt with as a matter of urgency, and I think you said that you agree with that. How urgently?
Well, I think if the department drafts the legislation, once we get finality in the judgment, if they draft the legislation and, you know, there's factors that need to be dealt with. It's not just Section 15 of the Act. We also have to deal with Section 15A, which is naturalisation of spouses of Irish citizens, which is slightly different in terms of Section 15. So let's get it right. Let's get the legislation then before the Oireachtas, when the Dáil and Shannon resume in September. And I think if we can enact it in mid-September, well, it won't have any prejudice on the applications which are before the minister at present.
But anybody who is about to apply, are you saying wait?
No, because I think legislation will be able to take into account that any applications which were made will be made under the new regime. So I don't think it is necessary for people to wait. Like, the whole purpose of granting certificates of naturalisation is that people who've lived in Ireland for a lengthy period of time, who've displayed commitment to the country,
yes,
who've indicated they're going to stay here long term, well, they should be granted certificates of naturalisation.
What sort of amendment could you put into the law to take into account the kind of circumstances that people would face in the year prior to applying?
Well,
are you saying that the discretionary power or the six-week rule, for example, that has been there, should be made legal?
Yeah, I think that is a good application. I think some discretion should be retained by the minister in terms of determining the length of time. I think we should take out the words continuous residence. I think we should replace them with maybe people being ordinarily resident here. I think the minister could prescribe what is ordinarily resident by regulations. But like, the rule that was being applied by the state to date is that you could be out of the country for up to 6 weeks, namely 42 days. So I think anyone who's in the country for more than 300 days in the preceding year is entitled to be granted their certificate of naturalisation. And I think we need some flexibility on the part of the minister who's granting the certificates, okay, to ensure it's not too rigid a regime.
Jim O'Callaghan, thank you very much for coming into this morning. That's Jim O'Callaghan, the Fianna Fáil spokesperson on justice.
The Adoption Authority says it's continuing to plan and prepare for changes to the adoption laws despite the decision by Minister Catherine Zappone to pause the process for more consultation. In its annual report, the authority has also urged more birth mothers to provide their details to the voluntary contact register. Patricia Carey is the CEO of the Adoption Authority and she's here with us this morning. Good morning to you.
Morning, Rachel.
How much of your work now relates to historic adoptions and how much relates to what's happening today?
Well, we try to balance, I suppose, there is a delicate balance between serving and working with the 48,000 cohort of people who were adopted since 1952. And we have 15,000 of those on a voluntary contact register. And we'd hope to increase that. And I suppose part of our annual report is appealing to birth parents to come forward. At the moment, we have 2/3 adoptees and 1/3 birth parents who are on this register, who can be matched, who can share information, and in some instances can have a reunion. And then we also balance with the current adoption landscape where, you know, thankfully there are more children in foster care being adopted. There are children who are infant adoptions, and then we have a small number of children who are adopted from overseas.
As you say, you're urging more birth mothers to come forward and to put their details on the contact register. Do you fear that some women are still wary of doing this because of the shameful way they were treated in the past?
I think there is an element of shame, but I think if you look at the cultural change in Ireland in the last 10 years...
And it should be said that those women should feel absolutely no shame. The shame was on the rest of society who treated them in that way.
Absolutely no shame at all. And we do have a dark history of adoption in Ireland, but I think that the social change in Ireland through referenda, we have seen that people can change their minds and change social views. And we have women coming forward who have heard, I suppose, the stories of other women, in particular birth mothers, who now we would strongly encourage to come forward, to share their information, to possibly share medical information, which could be very valuable for their adopted children. And in some instances, as I said, they may wish to have a reunion with their children that, it, you know, they sadly gave up for adoption, and they may feel that this would be healing for them. And we would strongly encourage them to talk to us, to talk to a trusted person, to talk to the Child and Family Agency, but most critically to register on the National Contact Preference Register. And we've over 15,000 people on it.
Is there a danger that in some cases these may be women who did try to find their son or daughter in the past and that those efforts may have been rebuffed?
Well, I think if you look at the story of Philomena Lee, we know that in some instances people were misled or maybe not helped. But certainly the chairman of the Adoption Authority, Dr. Geoffrey Shannon, and myself would say that now we're in a culture of openness and a spirit of openness. And we want people, if they feel they can come forward again, we will absolutely help them. We will take their details. If their child is on the register, we will make contact with them, and hopefully there will be a happy outcome for lots of the birth mothers who come forward. We're in a changed Ireland from the 50s, 60s and 70s, and we can see that from many of the people who come forward now, that they're happy to talk to their families. There is no more shame and stigma around this, and it would be great healing for those women.
You received 121 requests for birth certs in 2018. You granted 43 of those requests. Why were so many refused?
There's a little bit of an anomaly there, because we have to look at the details behind each request. So it wouldn't be a direct match for match. And in some instances, unfortunately, when we contact the birth parents, we do contact them, the original birth cert, they are afraid. Maybe they haven't told their families. They have fear that if their name is released. But I think we've seen from other jurisdictions that issuing or releasing original birth certs is not going to cause the sky to fall in. And in most cases where we talk to birth parents and encourage them and tell them that, you know, this is going to be a positive outcome for the adopted adult child and for themselves, that over time and with support and counselling and talking to their families, that generally they will agree to the birth certs being released.
It's a huge, huge issue in this country. And I know that in the past, people have complained about how long the tracing process can take, that there is delay upon delay. Have sufficient resources been allocated?
Well, I mean, as a state employee, I'm never going to say there's enough resources. I think the contact register, if it was activated, if it was an active register, we would certainly, one of the goals of the chairman, Dr. Geoffrey Shannon, would be to go around the world. Many of these birth mothers, unfortunately, moved abroad after they relinquish their children.
And this is it. Every time this is in the news, and say you listen to Liveline, you hear English accents and American accents,
Australia,
one after another.
Canada. We want to reach out to those women, and we want them to hear a new story from Ireland, a new welcome, that we want them to come back, we want them to register, we want them to share their information. But remember that if somebody moved in the 60s or 70s, we have to go through a very, I suppose, confidential and a very sensitive process in finding out where they are now and then making contact with them.
Just finally and briefly, is legal change necessary?
Well, you know, legal change, at the moment there is no legislation for information tracing in Ireland. So I think we'll wait and see what happens over the next coming months.
Patricia Carey, CEO of the Adoption Authority, thank you for joining us
on
Morning Ireland.
The government, as we've been reporting this morning, is expected to oppose an EU plan to end seasonal clock changes. The matter is set to be discussed at today's cabinet meeting. Member states were asked to inform the European Commission this year if they'd like to choose permanent summer or winter time and end the twice yearly clock changes. MEPs have already voted in favour of abolishing daylight saving. Fine Gael, Ireland South MEP Sean Kelly is among those. In fact, he was Ireland's only member on the European Parliament Working Group on the biannual clock change, and he's on the line this morning. A very good morning to you, Sean Kelly, and thanks for taking our call.
What do you make of
these reports we hear this morning that Charlie Flanagan is to ask the government to reject this proposal to end the clock changes?
Yes, in fairness to Minister Flanagan, he was in touch with me yesterday advising me that this was going to be the recommendation. And while I regret it, I can understand it in the context of Brexit. And it is just an example again of where Brexit is a negative effect, because if the United Kingdom were to oppose it, and they probably would at this point in time, then you would have a rather farcical situation in Ireland where we'd have the same time as Northern Ireland for 6 months of the year, and we'd be an hour behind them or ahead of them, depending on which course we would take for the other 6 months of the year. And obviously that doesn't make any practical sense. But at the same time, I think that in due course, this will be discussed in Brussels at a council meeting, and it's quite likely that it might get the go-ahead. So then we'd have to see what would happen.
Well, the choice laid by the EU before EU member states was to either to stay in winter time or summer time. What happens if a government like the Irish government says, actually, we're just going to leave things the way they are?
Well, if the council meets and they have a qualified majority, which they need, 55% of member states, 65% of the population, then I think each member state will be obliged to go with that. But obviously we'd be in a difficult position if the United Kingdom didn't agree, and we'd probably have to seek a derogation in that instance until at least the United Kingdom would change its mind, which I think is quite likely. I don't see how the United Kingdom would decide forever have this situation we have now, changing the clock twice a year, if the rest of Europe decided they didn't want it. Especially in the public consultation that was done, over 80% of respondents from the United Kingdom wanted an end to the biannual clock change. That surely has to reflect the opinion of the citizens of the United Kingdom, and that has to be taken into consideration. But because of Brexit at this point in time, the answer to everything is probably no, no, no.
But in the immediate future, we could be looking at a situation where we continue with daylight saving, but countries like France or Germany, Portugal, Spain, they would stick on the same time throughout the 12 months of the year.
That's correct. And that's one of the difficulties we are facing now, again, mainly because of Brexit, because all the indications are, and all the research we've done, is that daylight savings has served its time. It has a negative effect, the biannual clock change, on animals, on people with depression, on light sleepers, people with autism. There are no energy savings, and it's inconvenient as well for many, many people. So I think the movement is irrevocable. Sooner or later, people are going to say, we're going to end it. And I quite expect that the United Kingdom will do the same, and obviously that would make it much easier for Ireland.
All right, well, we shall see. Sean Kelly of Fine Gael, thanks very much indeed for taking our call this morning. It's a minute and a half to nine.
The Iranian ambassador to Ireland has called on the Irish government to intervene in a diplomatic row between the United States and the Islamic Republic on sanctions. It comes as tensions rise in the Gulf, the latest Donald Trump stating last night that the United States destroyed an Iranian drone in the Strait of Hormuz. Jackie Fox has been looking at the controversy.
Jubilant crowds on the streets of Iran's capital in 2015 after the country signed a deal to curb its nuclear program. The pact limited Iran's nuclear activity in return for easing economic sanctions, but it only took 3 years and a new US president for it to crumble. Donald Trump said the deal didn't do enough to curb Iran's ballistic missiles program.
In a few moments, I will sign a presidential memorandum to begin reinstating U.S. nuclear sanctions on the Iranian regime.
Oil and finance deals were restricted, with oil exports falling by 1.5 million barrels a day. Inflation predicted to reach 40% this year.
They are practically violating the human rights of 82 million people of Iran.
Iran's ambassador to Ireland is Masoud Eslami.
Depriving them of their right to peace, security, prosperity and development. Because, you know, these sanctions have affected the people of Iran in a very similar way that it has the Irish people have been affected by the famine which was imposed by the foreign intervention.
Between March 2018 and March 2019, Ireland sold Iran around 140 million euro worth of goods, and that could be at risk because of the sanctions, said the ambassador.
So we consider that the relations between Iran and Ireland to continue in terms of trade, in terms of political engagement.
Do you think it will be affected, though, that trade with the continuation of sanctions and the financial and economic restrictions there?
To a certain degree, yes. This will be the inevitable consequences.
However, Middle East expert Azadeh Movani said the sanctions can't be fully to blame for Iran's turmoil.
Iran's economy has struggled and has been challenged for years and years. So it didn't arrive at that moment with a strong economy to start with. So it was an economy that had never really blossomed because of Iran's political isolation. Iran is a country that chronically has labor protests about, you know, unpaid salaries. So I think that people are very, very squeezed, and the kind of humanitarian impact of the sanctions is very dispiriting. I think there's a huge amount of anxiety, but I think people largely blame this current state of affairs on the outside and on quite unfair kind of American grudge against Iran, but I don't think that they're blaming their government for that.
But things have gotten progressively worse with the sanctions, according to one Iranian living in Ireland. Wanting to remain anonymous, his comments are voiced by a member of the RTE newsroom.
There's a general shift to lower quality of life and lower economic capability. All prices have gone up by around 3 times in the last year, but wages and salaries haven't increased. The lower and middle classes have been most affected. People have scaled back on buying meat. And there have always been beggars in Tehran, but now there are more, and some are homeless. It's also hard to go back to Iran too. Flights are double the cost and harder to get. Some airlines no longer fly through some major airport hubs. It's a mix of the sanctions, and government could do a better job too. Some sectors are suffering from corruption, poor practices, lack of organisation, but you can find that in Greece and Italy. My friends and family are sad and sorry.
Iran is calling for Europe to convince Washington to lift sanctions. If not, it will keep breaching the nuclear deal every 60 days, after doing so for the first time in July. Iran's ambassador to Ireland calling for intervention.
The government of Ireland have a vibrant capacity to use their reputation for neutrality to offer their good offices and to bring up diplomatic initiatives to help to de-escalate the tensions in our region. And Iran is open to receive and consider any serious diplomatic initiative, particularly by a friendly country like Ireland. We understand that Ireland is seeking membership of the United Nations Security Council. This would put Ireland in a better position to get involved in providing more support and more diplomatic initiatives for helping to de-escalate the tensions in Persian Gulf region.
A spokesperson at the Department of Foreign Affairs said that Taoiseach Simon Coveney has consistently called for dialogue between all parties in the Gulf.
Please. Thanks, President.
In the European Parliament this week, though, one Irish MEP, Mick Wallace, said Europe was too silent.
We have the sanctions against Iran, which is a form of warfare, one of the worst forms of warfare today. And what is Europe doing about it? Do you want Saudi and Israel to push the US into war with Iran? Why don't you end the sanctions? Iran wants peace, not war.
I think the Trump administration does not want any kind of military confrontation. I think the Iranians don't want one either.
Azadeh Movani again.
I think the thing to watch will be in September. September, we have Iran's 60-day deadline that it's kind of set for the Europeans to see some action on what they can do to mitigate the cost of the US pulling out for Iran. I think it will probably be a holding pattern until September.
That report by Jackie Falk.
Six new regional health areas are being formed as part of a shake-up of the health service. The health minister, Simon Harris, insisted the change didn't signal a return to the old health board system, which was dismantled 14 years ago. He also pledged that once the plan was implemented, there would be fewer managers. The change is part of the reforms being introduced under the Sláinte Care programme. The executive director of Sláinte Care, Laura McGahey, is with us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Richard.
At the moment, there are regional hospital groups. So how will these new areas differ from what's in place now?
What we have at the moment is areas that don't overlap. We have 9 community healthcare organisations, and yet we have 6 hospital groups. And so it is impossible to plan for the needs of the population in an integrated way. It is a legacy of past disjointed policies, and it is something that is being addressed, and I'm delighted that it has been addressed and that it will give us the way to move forward now in a joined up way to plan for the people of Ireland.
Under the old health board system, local politicians had a say and there were public meetings. Will that system return?
The governance of the health areas is to be decided, but it will be based on competency. So in the way that all public boards are now appointed, it would be through a public appointment system.
So there won't be, politicians won't be on the boards as they were in the past?
Well, if politicians applied through the public appointment system, then they would be perfectly entitled to be a member, but it would be through a public appointment system as opposed to a representative way.
And what about that idea of public meetings? Because in the past, if a person was interested in what was happening as far as the health system was concerned in their own particular area, they could go along and have a listen.
And that sounds like an excellent idea. I think more open governance is something that we would certainly subscribe to, and something we're very keen to do and have been doing in the Sláinte Care Programme Office. We've been working with the Joint Committee on Health to keep them informed, and I've published our report just yesterday for our half-yearly report. So I think all kinds of public accountability is a very good thing.
One of the key objectives of Sláinte Care, as people will know, is to provide the majority of care at home or closer to home. So how will what was announced yesterday speed up this process?
That is the whole point of it, in the sense that it will cut the barriers between the hospital groups and the communities. At the moment, they have 2 separate budgets. So we're aware of waiting times for people to be discharged from hospital. We're aware that there are financial incentives for performing certain types of operations, etc., within a hospital context. This will remove those barriers and will provide one budget for the population, which is going to be done and allocated based on the numbers within each region, then based on the age profile within each region, based on the ability of the people in the region and the deprivation index. So it'll be a far more equitable distribution than what has than what happens at the moment.
You spoke there about breaking down barriers. Simon Harris says yesterday promised that these changes will result in fewer managers. Do you honestly believe that there are going to be fewer managers?
What we know is that at the moment we have 15 management structures. In the new system, we will have 6. It's inappropriate for me to discuss anything to do with the management of the system at the moment.
But will there have to be a redundancy programme?
That's all to be worked out and hasn't been discussed yet. And the
But otherwise, where will those people go?
Well, that is, as you say, that is something that has to be worked out over the next while. I mean, what we're proposing is that these structures will be up and running by 2021. So over the next number of months, we'll be having regional fora, which we're really excited to invite the public to, and to involve citizens and ask them how they would like to see their services develop. And it's a real opportunity for people to get involved in Sláinte care.
I should imagine that one of the things people will say to you, and this was something raised by the former HSE boss, Tony O'Brien, on Drive Time yesterday, was the simple lack of hospital beds. And he cited the case of University Hospital in Limerick in particular, where there's now a severe problem all year round. So what's this going to do to provide more beds in a place like University Hospital Limerick?
There is a severe lack of beds. The capacity review, which was conducted by PA, was launched last year, and it has identified the need for 2,600 more acute beds in the system. In fact, it identified the need for 7,000 beds if reforms weren't taking place. So the reforms that are taking place will be enabled, in fact, by this regional structure.
But system. When will people start to see a difference?
Already, I would say people are seeing a difference, but they won't see a difference until we build more hospital beds. And that is part of the capital planning process that we're undertaking at the moment. So in reality, there are things that will be done and that can be done to improve the length of stay in hospitals and therefore reduce the amount of beds that are rather make more accessible the amount of beds that are available. But there is definitely a need for extra capacity, not just in the hospitals. And this is against a backdrop of a rising population. We will have 500,000 more people living in Ireland, and they are living longer and they are living with more complex conditions. So there is an additional pressure on the hospital and on the community system. So I suppose what the new regional system will do, it will enable us to plan on the basis of the population, on the needs of the population, on the age profile, so that we can provide care closer to home or in the home, so people don't need to go to hospital. And that is what this system will provide. And we have seen lots and lots of good examples of things happening all around the country in our visits to people in the communities in particular, but also there's excellent work happening in the hospitals. Double heart and lung transplant was performed in the Mater Hospital just last week. There's amazing work happening which keeps people out of hospitals.
All right. All right, Laura McGahey, Executive Director of Sláinte Care. Thank you very much for joining us on the programme this morning. It's 25 minutes past 7.
Finalists for the first time in more than a quarter of a century, England has ended its long wait for a Cricket World Cup, captained by an Irishman. Owen Morgan from Rush in North Dublin lifted the trophy after a dramatic, heart-stopping encounter with New Zealand yesterday. At the conclusion of normal play, the two sides were tied and remained tied after the Super Over, the equivalent of a penalty shootout. England won on boundaries. Speaking to BBC Radio immediately after the win, Owen Morgan admitted that he thought the game was slipping away from them.
Probably when Chris Wokes got out, I think Liam Plunkett came in and got us back into the game, and Ben Stokes would have had to do a lot to get us over. I thought we had a lot of rub of the green with Ben's overthrows and everything that happened.
That was remarkable, wasn't it?
I would have loved to hear the commentary on that. I don't know how you describe it.
I'll play it to you, so I said it was a complete fluke.
Oh, but that's a bit of luck sometimes that gets you over.
England cricket captain Owen Morgan from Rush. Well, our reporter Louise Byrne visited Rush Cricket Club yesterday, where friends and fans of Owen were watching the final.
He was a tiny little red-headed fella. He was an under 11, you see, when he played, when he was here. He came up, he was probably an under 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. But he left us then and went elsewhere. But as an under 11, he was a grand little fella. Well, he'd come in, he'd jump out of his daddy's car, dragging a bat behind him, even when he was... when he was very small, you know, tiny. And he was a grand little fella. And he always had a bat with him. And if he played, or even if when he was in the nets, you could see this extraordinary talent he had.
The kids look up to him, and he's come out here several times, and it's been great. And they have someone to look up to, they have someone to sort of associate with, and someone to achieve, to be. And I think that's very important in modern day sports, to have role models, whether male or whether they're female. So, you know, we all have role models, and we're lucky that we've Owen Morgan associated with this club, especially as a young cricketer. He's been here since, you know, associated with the club when he was a 6-year-old, and, you know, up to their age here, and he was a special talent at 6 years of age, like, you know, and you always knew, hope that maybe he might have done something, but no one could foreseen what he has actually achieved, which has been amazing.
Yeah, I look up to him a lot. He is an inspiration to a lot of people in Rush as well, since he did play here when he was younger, and he did start his cricket career in this ground that we're all standing on right now.
One of Owen Morgan's young fans speaking there to Louise Byrne yesterday evening. We can talk now to Alan Butterley, who's chair of Rush Cricket Club, and to Owen's dad, Jodie Morgan, is on the line. A very good morning to you both, and thanks for taking our calls this morning. I'm sure you're immensely proud this morning, Jodie, of everything that Owen has achieved. I mean, as we heard one of those contributors a moment ago, you could see his talent even at a very early age, just 6 years of age. It was a passion from early on, obviously.
Thanks, Brian, for having us this morning. We're absolutely over the moon. I have to correct Sean McCann, whoever said that in Rush. He was actually 4 when he fielded with his brothers Gareth and Gavin on an under-11 match. And we, you know, most people probably wouldn't know, but we would have seen an awful lot of the talent that Owen has as a person, how strong-willed he is, how much in touch he is with life and with cricket. Doesn't get carried away, be calm. He got great instruction from Kevin Jennings in Catholic University School. Kevin would always say, always tell him to be calm no matter what happens. Yeah. And I have to, before I forget, Rush Cricket Club, where he spent, and we all spent as a family, very happy days. It's really heartwarming to hear them talk about him. And there's a glow this morning here. It's just unreal, Brian.
I mean, as well, obviously, as being an outstanding athlete, just very skilled with bat and ball on the cricket field. You know, when you're captain as well, there's a whole lot of other qualities come into play. Obviously, leadership is central to that. Did he show those sort of signs early on as well, Jodie?
Yeah, at a very young age. Owen could have been probably professional when he was 10 or 11 or 12. Looking after his body, he wouldn't drink Coke, he didn't eat chips, he didn't do all the things that I suppose ordinary youth would do that time. He knew where he was going from a very young age, and he was able to control all that as well. He done that. He didn't need instruction in that. He spent some time with the professional cricketer in Russia at the time was Nazir Shokat. He spent a lot of time with him. I spoke to him before the World Cup, and he still would be texting him. Owen was a great fella for taking information. You know, there's a lot of people don't listen, but he would take from people everything that they, and he would keep it to himself, and you'd say, geez, where did he get that from? But he would have got that from people that he had experience with.
Alan Butterley, if I can come to you, chair of Rush Cricket Club, obviously huge interest in Owen's career, huge excitement obviously through this tournament and particularly yesterday, and a great boost to cricket for Ireland, and particularly I suppose in North County Dublin as well.
Yeah, Brian, it was a fantastic day yesterday. We're still trying to get over here at the minute. Just like to say to Jody there, well, he's on the line, congratulations as well. Like, just thinking back on Jody and all the time he put into him as well. So fair play. All hard work was rewarded there yesterday. And anyway, so it was. But yeah, now coming back to the cricket club, yeah, the profile of the cricket club has after been lifted all right in the last week, so it is. So we're after getting a great buzz out of it, so yeah.
Of course, there's huge interest and involvement in cricket in Fingal. I mean, it's in a sense what hurling is to Kilkenny or football is to Kerry. It's the really sport, isn't it, for so many people?
Yeah, it's big around the Fingal area. Of course, you're always going to have the Gaelic Games taking a good bit away from it as well. But in the Fingal area, there's a pocket of clubs there within a 10-mile radius, and there's a lot of good cricketers that do come out of that area, so it is.
And Jodie, Owen, am I correctly informed, played a bit of hurling in his time as well?
He played a bit of hurling. My wife Olivia, her cousin was a Dublin goalkeeper back in 90, I think, when they won the hurling. It must have been the Dublin Championship, mm-hmm. or the Leinster Championship at the time. So my grandfather played hurling. Owen is a fourth generation cricketer with us. My grandfather, my father, and I played. And he seems to embrace that. you know, that the importance of that when he would be representing himself, his family, and his country, and his adopted country. He's very proud of all that. He carries all that with him all the time. He has an immense amount of stuff in his head, you know, that he controls, apart from the game as well. You know, it's he's very... Well, he got great education, I must say. And Alan was talking about the, and we talk about sport in general. I got a call from Keith Barr this morning, John Costello last night. All the people that have facilitated us and facilitated him in turn, the GAA, Galway GAA, no, Mayo, them all, even the ones we don't like when Dublin are playing them. The amount of people and the goodwill is unreal. People that I worked with in Trinity College as well. Well, some fantastic people, and the backing for cricket, and sport is so small, Brian, as you probably know, and Alan, sports people are very close, no matter what code you play in, GAA, cricket, soccer, no matter what it is. It's we live in a fantastic country, Brian, in Ireland. We have everything going for us.
Well, listen, it's a terrific story of sporting success. I see that the British media are putting Owen up there with Martin Johnson in rugby and Bobby Moore in soccer as a captain who raised a World Cup for England. And that's a tremendous achievement to him, to everybody who worked with him over the years there in Rush, and of course to all his teammates as well. And to New Zealand, who put in a terrific performance, it should be said, in yesterday's match. Listen, we leave it there. Thanks so much to Jody Morgan and to Alan Butterley for talking to us from Rush. The time now is just a minute.
The role played by women in the effort to bring electricity to rural Ireland is being celebrated at a new exhibition at the National Museum of Country Life in County Mayo. Kitchen Power gathers the memories of many women who witnessed the transition to electrical power and the changes it brought in the 1950s and 1960s. Our Western correspondent Pat McGrath reports.
In 1946, one of the most important pieces of our national planning was put underway when work was begun on rural electrification.
An extract from one of many public information films produced by the ESB to promote the take-up of electrical power in homes around the country. Over two decades from the mid-1940s, a major investment brought irrevocable change to rural Ireland.
Rural electrification, it's described as the greatest social revolution since the land reforms of the 1880s and 1890s, and it is so true, and it very much sums up the whole community spirit all around the country.
Women were key to the success of this programme, with numerous publicity campaigns to convince housewives about the benefits that awaited them.
The out-and-out cleanliness of electric lighting, cooking and heating has done away with the old-time drudgery.
Deirdre McPartland is the senior archivist with the ESB.
We did a lot of advertising in national and local newspapers, but even more so than that, we connected with the people on a one-to-one level, and this is where ESB really knew to get the whole country behind the scheme in rural Ireland particularly. So ESB had lady demonstrators who travelled around the country doing demonstrations for baking, utilising all the electrical appliances to put people's mind at ease.
There's no equipment in this kitchen beyond the wish of the average Irish housewife. All these modern helps can be yours.
For the new exhibition at the Museum of Country Life, oral histories, appliances, press cuttings, video footage and stories have all been gathered together to emphasise the way in which electricity changed Irish society. The event is being overseen by Dr. Saoirse O'Brien of Kingston University in London.
What you don't get out of the historical archives, or you don't get out of the newspaper or the media coverage at the time, is what did it actually mean to people? How did it feel? Where we've got some of the recordings that we did as part of the Oral History Project, which are in the exhibition, where people are talking about the difference that it made to them and also to their mothers, in some cases grandmothers, just the sheer joy of being able to turn on a light and have this bright light very, very quickly, but also as well to be able to reduce the drudgery, because that's the one word that keeps coming up, is drudgery about housework. To try and actually reduce that.
You'd hear, well, we have this because my sister in somewhere else, could be, you know, elsewhere in the country, my sister, she got one of those, and she says it's the thing she needed.
We got an electric kettle first, and then we got
a ring. And then a big purchase was made when Mammy and Daddy bought a cooker, an electric cooker.
One of the most striking aspects of all this is the sheer pace of change that was witnessed. Noreen Durkin was a young girl in the 1950s when Ballintubber was connected to the grid. She recalls the impact across the generations.
Yes, you see, today we haven't electricity for 10 minutes. We think we're fit of our lives, don't we? We can't do without it at all. It was a great blessing. It certainly, I have no doubt to say, it was the single greatest blessing ever happened to Irish women, and men, of course, as well, because they also had, you know, they got the better of it as well. But for women in the house, you know, doing all the slavery, and it was slavery, it was pure slavery. When I look back now and see what my mother and all the ladies in the village did, and they did it with, you know, they didn't complain because that's the way everybody was. Nobody had anything better than anybody else. At that time, we didn't realise, no, we, as young people, we didn't realise how much it was going to help us. It was gradual, really, because it was only when we got something extra new, you know, that we kind of thought this was great.
Noreen Durkin ending that report from Pat McGrath in County Mayo, and the Kitchen Power exhibition opens today at the Museum of Country Life.
September the 12th, 1962, US President John F. Kennedy tells a crowd at Rice Stadium in Houston, Texas, that man will land on the moon by the end of the decade. 8 years later, July 16th, 1969, 50 years ago today, Apollo 11 blasted off from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. Here's a reminder of some of the sounds from that lunar story, when humanity achieved what few dared to dream and touched the moon.
We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win, and the others too.
Apollo 11 is man's first attempt to demonstrate the ability to go to the moon, to land there, and to return to Earth.
We are still go with Apollo 11, 30 seconds and counting. Astronauts report it feels good. T-minus 25 seconds. 20 seconds and counting. T-minus 15 seconds. Guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9. Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11. Tower cleared.
Eagle, you're looking great. Coming up 9 minutes.
We're now in the approach phase. Everything looking good.
Okay, 75 feet. Guys looking good. Down a half. Pick forward. Contact light.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
How am I doing?
You're doing fine.
Okay, Neil, we can see you coming down the ladder now.
Yeah, I'm going to step off the limb now.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
The voice of astronaut Neil Armstrong, the first man to walk on the lunar surface. Well, we can talk now to Brian Harvey, who's an author on space matters and someone who's been looking back, as many of us have, at this period on its 50th anniversary. Brian, you're very welcome to the programme. Thanks for coming to talk to us. We intend to win, President Kennedy. We heard him in that clip say there. That was the context of all this, wasn't it? It was the rivalry between the United States and Russia, the Soviet Union, to put the first man on the moon.
There was that too, but it's also important to remember that Kennedy struggled during his presidency to find issues that reverberated with people. Kennedy loved speaking to students on campuses, unlike some future presidents. And when he spoke to students, the one subject that really got them going was the moon project. They started clapping and cheering and interrupting him all the time, as you heard on that particular tape. And it's also important that there was this extraordinary sense of enthusiasm for things space, be they Russian or American. There was a period of very, very rapid space development. Every few months, there'd be a big space shot by the Americans or the Russians, and they were playing catch up, the one with the other, throughout the 1960s. And even during the Apollo 11 mission, Russia launched a moon probe, Luna 15, 3 days before the recording we heard of Apollo 11 taking off. There was great speculation as to what it was trying to do. Well, we know now it was trying to land on the surface and bring rocks back to Earth before Apollo 11 by a few hours. And it's a great game of what if, had it succeeded in doing so.
And of course, we also now know that President Kennedy sought perhaps to cooperate with the Russians in space exploration.
We know that Kennedy was greatly worried about the cost of going to the moon, as was Khrushchev on the other side. And he began to put out feelers to Khrushchev in autumn 1963, within a few months before his assassination. And according to Sergei Khrushchev, his son, Nikita Khrushchev, was about to respond positively when, tragically, that came to an end. And Lyndon Johnson had no interest in a collaborative venture with the Soviet Union.
You've talked about the intensity of the exploration program through the 1960s. There was the Mercury program, then followed by Apollo. And as it got towards this date 50 years ago, it really was at an extraordinary level. I was looking at the timeline. There were something like 5 manned missions, Apollo missions, in the space of just several months leading up to July 1969.
They were. They built up to an absolutely frantic pace at the end. They did have the deadline at the end of the year, but it was a very carefully programmed and phased program so that they believed they weren't cutting corners, although they were taking enormous risks. And I think it's worth emphasising that the difference between glorious success and probably fatal failure were very, very narrow. The computers they had in those days had less memory than the average digital wristwatch does now. They were navigating to and from the moon using sextants and slide rules, using quite shaky communication lines at times. So it was an extraordinarily daring venture. And I think that the worldwide interest in the moon landing very much recognized the courage of these men in doing something that was so very difficult, so very dangerous, and their chances of coming back. I mean, Neil Armstrong himself said there was a 10% chance we wouldn't come back at all, and maybe a chance that Michael Collins even would have to return home on his own.
All right, and more besides that we haven't time to talk about, but we will be talking about it, the landing and the return in the days ahead as those anniversaries fall. Brian Harvey, for the moment, thank you very much indeed for being with us.
You've been listening to a selection of stories from this week's Morning Ireland.